And welcome to Conversations with the Academy, a podcast from the University of Arkansas School of Law. My name is Dorinda Sharp.
And I'm Colin Hesse. On this episode, Dorinda talks with Joel Goldstein, the Vincent C. Immo Professor of Law at St. Louis University School of Law. He was on campus as part of the Hartman Hotz Lectures in Law and Liberal Arts and to discuss his research on the vice presidency.
We hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
How did you get into studying the vice presidency?
It was sort of an accident. It wouldn't have happened but for Spiro Agnew. When I was in college, I needed a topic for a course paper. Vice President Agnew had just resigned, and the country was going to have the first implementation of the 25th Amendment, which was has the procedure to replace a vice president where the president nominates somebody and the House and Senate can confirm them. My dad had seen something about it and suggested that might be an interesting topic, and I wrote about it. And I got really interested in the 25th Amendment and presidential succession. And then later somebody suggested that a book on the vice presidency hadn't been written in a while. And so I wrote my first book on the vice presidency, and I just kept returning to it and looking at it from different angles and as it progressed.
What's the most interesting or surprising tidbit you've run across in your years of research?
Well, there's so many. I think the thing that excites me about the vice presidency is that here you have this office that for most of our history was sort of a laughing stock. I mean, it was the most disparaged office. Presidents, vice presidents, comedians, everybody used it for target practice. And now, really ever since the Carter-Mondale administration, it's been a very significant position. And now the vice president really is very much the second officer. And so I've been interested in studying how that's happened and thinking about whether the trajectory of the vice presidency from nothing to something very special also might have some lessons that other institutions of our government could use to improve their performance and their acceptability.
That's interesting. So over the course of our history, it's also been kind of hit and miss whether or not the vice presidency is a stepping stone to the presidency, assuming something terrible doesn't happen to the president. Do you have any thoughts on why that sometimes is, you know, a stepping stone to the next thing? And sometimes once you're vice president, you can't get elected president to save your life.
In the early period, the vice president was the runner-up in the presidential election. So John Adams and then Thomas Jefferson really were the second highest electoral vote winner. So it was somewhat logical that they would become president. Then the system was changed, and many of the vice presidents were pretty undistinguished people through most of the 19th century and some of the 20th century. I think beginning with the vice presidency of Richard Nixon, the vice presidency really moved into the executive branch. And from Nixon on, vice presidents tended to be either nominated for president or they tended to be important parts of the presidential conversation. So now I think it's become a very good springboard. Doesn't mean that the vice president's going to make it. I mean, there's some challenges. If the president's unpopular, the vice president's going to inherit that unpopularity. If the president has some problems, even if they don't relate to the vice president, the vice president's that's going to pose a problem for him or her as well. But I think the vice presidency now puts somebody in a better position than any other office. You know, there's 100 senators and there's 50 governors at any one time. And so that even where we see a senator making it or a governor making it, there's 99 or 49 that didn't. Mm-hmm. So I think the vice presidency really has become a very important springboard. It's no guarantee, but for most people, it's an asset.
So out of all of these personalities that you've studied, do you have any characters that you have a particular affinity for?
Well, I mean, my favorite vice president really is Walter Mondale. I think because he really came up with the new vision of the office that really transformed it. And when he came up with it, it was a counterintuitive vision. But it's one thing to have the idea. It's another thing to be able to implement it. And he did that really very successfully over the 4 years that he and President Carter were in office. And he's a very decent, humble person. So I really have a lot of respect and admiration for him. But we've had a number of vice presidents, who have been colorful figures. Thomas Marshall, who was Woodrow Wilson's vice president, was really, I think, our funniest vice president. He was the person who said that what this country needs is a good 5-cent cigar. And apparently what happened is he was presiding over the Senate one day, and somebody was giving a speech, and he was beginning every sentence by saying, what this country needs is X, what this country needs is Y, what this country needs is Z. And finally, when he said, what this country needs, Vice President Marshall said, a good 5-cent cigar. So he had a number of quips that were very good. And there have been a number of other colorful vice presidents. But Walter Mondale, in terms of what he contributed, I think in a historic way, is really my favorite.
That's great. So because of what you study, you're in a pretty small niche, which this time of year, every 4 years, you kind of become the man of the hour for a lot of reporters and pundits and all of that sort of thing. Could you talk a little bit about how that's affected your life and your studies as far as, you've been interviewed by the Huffington Post and the New York Times and I could go on and on and on, ABC Radio.
My wife says I'm like an exotic plant that blooms every 4 years. it's fun. What happens is that once the presidential nomination is resolved, the media gets interested in who's going to be the running mate. It becomes the big political story. And a number of times people will call me, and of course I don't have any inside information about who anyone's going to pick. But what I can talk about is sort of historical patterns, things that people have looked at in the past. And oftentimes when people talk about selection, they focus on certain ideas that really are myths. Mm-hmm. One of the things that it gets focused on a lot is people talk about that the vice president will come from a big, important state with a lot of electoral votes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that happens, but usually it's not. Sarah Palin was from Alaska, Dick Cheney, Wyoming, mm-hmm. Joe Biden, Delaware, all with 3 or 4 electoral votes. So I can talk about those sorts of things. And it's been fun for me because a lot of times the national media will ask questions or they'll share information that I'm otherwise not privy to, or they'll ask questions that cause me to learn new things or to think about problems in ways that I haven't thought about them before. Anytime somebody wants to talk about a subject that you're interested in, yeah, it's a real treat. And so to have people interested in talking about something that I've spent a lot of time studying, it's fun, and it's in a way it's an extension of teaching, just in a different context. Mm-hmm. But it's a sort of teaching where I find that that I learn a lot from talking to particularly the good reporters. And And there's some who I just spoke to one just the other day, and sort of about every 4 years, it sort of become a joke between us that every 4 years he calls me and we have a conversation, and I may not hear from him again until hopefully in 2016 or maybe again this year. But
mm-hmm. That's fantastic. So speaking of the media, the vice presidency has hit pop culture in a new way since HBO's Veep came on the air. Do you have, have you watched it? Have you been part of it at all? Have you consulted? Do you have thoughts on what they get right, what they get wrong, any of that?
I've watched some of Veep, not all of them. I haven't consulted. One time somebody called me up with a idea for a show about the vice presidency, and we talked, and I never heard anything more about it. I think that oftentimes in the pop culture, the way the vice president's treated, I think, is misleading. So I enjoy Veep, but it seems to me that it caricatures the office and the people around it. I mean, if you talk to some of the people who've worked at the high levels for the last half dozen vice presidents, they're really impressive, able people.
Right.
And they have no resemblance to the sort of the clowns that surround the vice president in Veep. I loved the show West Wing, but the one thing I didn't like about it was that the Vice President Hoynes, was always on sort of the old model of the vice president, where he wasn't included. Nowadays, the vice president spends a lot of time with the president. Vice President Biden's with the president constantly, and they have weekly luncheons. The vice president's voice, Vice President Biden's voice, Vice President Cheney's voice, is one the president wants to hear, even if he doesn't follow his advice. It's important input that the president wants to hear, and pop culture tends not to portray that. It tends to portray the vice president of the past that we sort of mocked and disparaged.
Since the University of Arkansas School of Law is on the flagship campus of our, you know, our major university in the state, we get a lot of graduate students who are interested in law school, who want to know what they should be doing to either prepare to get into law school or prepare to succeed in law school once they get in. Do you have any advice?
Well, I think that in terms of getting into law school, I think doing well in your undergraduate program, having a strong GPA, and then doing well on the LSAT tend to be two of the most important criteria. In terms of doing well in law school, I think that law school doesn't really lend itself very well to cramming at the end. And so I try and encourage my students to really try and learn the material as they go, so that if you can really integrate it, not think of memorizing material, but really knowing it, that it tends to be easier to work with the material and to draw connections. So, I mean, just as you know the way our students know how to get home and they know who how to cook their favorite recipe or play their favorite piece on the violin or who's the starting lineup of their favorite sports team, you want to get so that legal principles that they're familiar with legal principles in the same sort of way, not because they memorized them. They didn't memorize any of those other things. They just learned them, and they know them because they're important to them.
It's almost like muscle memory.
I think it really is very much like muscle memory. It's that you do it enough, you care about it enough, so that you find that that you know the concepts, and so you know what are the elements of a particular offense, or what are the particular criteria to think about when you're applying a particular constitutional provision. You know it because you've thought about it enough, you've done it enough. It's not that you've memorized it, but it's there.
You've internalized it,
exactly.
So you did your undergraduate work at Princeton and graduated summa cum laude, I saw. What did you study? What was your bachelor's degree in?
I majored in the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs, and so I took a lot of courses in politics and American history, that was really the focus of my undergraduate work.
Do you think that served you well as you moved into law school?
I think it did, but I think it did because I was really interested in that material, and so I think it engaged me. I think there's no one curriculum that somebody should take to go to law school. I think the important thing really is is to be intellectually curious and interested. So that, I mean, I've had law students who are great students who were philosophy majors or science majors or English majors or government majors or political science majors. Sometimes I'll find a student will come to me and say, I've read these cases before because I took a constitutional law course undergrad. And sometimes those students do very well in law school, but sometimes they don't do as well. Mm-hmm. So I think the important thing really is to approach whatever area that you're studying with enthusiasm and interest and curiosity.
Did you have an idea going into undergrad that you would go on to law school, or did that develop while you were in school?
Well, I sort of grew up thinking that I was going to go to law school. My dad was a lawyer, and he loved the law. He loved the practice of law, and so he would talk a lot about it. And so from a young age, I had a real love and respect for the law and the legal system, and so I always assumed that I was going to go to law school. And when I went to law school, and I thought that the curriculum, the courses were just fascinating. I loved the first year curriculum. It was sort of the building blocks of society, and so I think it's a wonderful discipline to study, and I think it's a discipline that also that can be useful for people who want to go into government or who want to go into business or who want to go into a number of other fields. But there's also, I think, a need for good and able and ethical and conscientious lawyers and as well.
So after you finished law school, you spent some time in practice before going into academia. What led you to teach as opposed to practice?
I'd always wanted to practice law with my dad. He'd started an admiralty law firm in 1957, and so I did that for 12 years, and I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed working with him and the other people. I started teaching admiralty as an adjunct while I was practicing, and I really loved it. And I'd done some teaching before, which I'd really enjoyed, but when I was teaching admiralty, I thought, you know, you're enjoying this so much that, and you're doing it in a time where you're having to prepare on the weekends and stealing time from your, you know, from my wife, my kids, my other activities and sleep and so forth. I thought if you're really enjoying it under these circumstances, you'd probably really enjoy it if you did it full time. And my wife and my children were in family were very supportive of me making the switch, and so that's really how I ended up teaching.
It's fantastic. Do you miss anything about practice?
I mean, I enjoyed the people I was working with. I enjoyed the in practice, you don't have to think about your hypotheticals because the hypotheticals are the new case that walks in your office. Mm-hmm. Things happen that you never would have imagined would happen. So I enjoyed that about practice, but I think it's very much of a personal decision. Some people are really cut out to be practicing lawyers, mm-hmm. and some people I think are better suited to be academics. And for me, I think being an academic is a better fit for me. I really enjoy teaching. I really enjoy the students, and I enjoy being able to pick the topics that I research about and write about. So I think it's really very much of a personal decision. And I think that's one of the challenges for all law students is that being happy in law practice is a function of picking an area that you're interested in. But it's also a question of thinking about the lifestyle choices and what works well for you. Mm-hmm. Some people really like to test themselves in combat or in competition. Mm-hmm. Some people like to tell stories or to do public speaking. Other people don't. Other people would rather be in a smaller settings and or be working, helping people plan or doing transactional sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And so some of having an enjoyable career in law, I think, is a function of figuring out what's are you best suited for? What makes you happiest? And then trying to pursue that sort of a career, that sort of a practice. It's not as if there's a right or a wrong answer. It's a it's a deeply personal and individual answer.
Thank you for your thoughts and advice and reminiscing. Appreciate your time.
Oh, it's been fun. I hope it's been helpful.
Great.
Music for Conversations with the Academy was written and performed by Josh Woodward. For more information and additional podcasts, go to kuaf.com or law.uart.edu. You can also listen to episodes or subscribe to our podcast through iTunes, on Stitcher, or with your favorite podcast app. Follow the University of Arkansas School of Law on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for UARK Law. That's UARKLAW. Thank you for listening.